101.1 FM, The Lakeshore. Listener-supported public radio in Northwest Indiana. WLPR FM, Lowell.
Today on Off Mic, we are now in the ninth month of the COVID-19 pandemic, and right now the disease shows no signs of slowing up. It continues to cause havoc with the economy and in schools. We talked to two teachers, one who recently resigned her position, about their experiences in the classroom during the COVID-19 era. But that's not all. An outbreak of COVID is now running through a local fire department. We talked to the head of a firefighters union to find out how they are staying safe and the city's response. And will it be winning ugly all over again? The Sox are considering a blast from the past to possibly manage their team more than 30 years since his firing. All this on Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic and Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ Chicago. If you're a parent of school-aged children like me, you know how difficult, weird, troubling, and confusing time it is. Some parents are torn on whether to send their children to in-person instruction or just keep them at home. Some school districts require in-person instruction, while some have given students the option of e-learning from home. But even when students are learning from home, teachers must head to the school to do it. And according to two of our guests today, that too comes with pitfalls and problems. Our first guest is Janine Diaz, a former teacher in the Highland School District. Good morning, Janine.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you, and thank you for joining us here on Off Mic. Janine, real quick, how long were you working with the Highland School District?
Oh, I would have started my fourth full year. That was where I did my student teaching, and then that's where I did my first 3 years.
And what did you teach?
I taught Spanish.
Spanish, okay.
In high school.
So when did you start having problems in the classroom?
With COVID, so we closed down back in March, and I kind of had kept an eye out about what was happening, so I was kind of expecting it to happen, and so we did a pretty good job with e-learning, I think, and then at the beginning of the year, we were teaching, the teachers had to be in school, and all of the kids, 100% of the kids were e-learning, and then around, it was in September, but it was basically like 2 or 3 weeks. And they told us that on September 28th, we were going to go back in person. And so then that's kind of, I guess, when the issue started happening because, that's when there were going to be people in the classroom.
And what were your concerns there with students in the classroom?
Yeah. So my concern is that with high school in particular, you have, about 150 kids as a teacher, and each kid has to go to a different class throughout the day, and they're essentially being exposed to the entire school throughout the day. And, you know, my classroom, for example, was pretty small, and I didn't have any windows, I didn't want to be exposed to so many kids. I mean, that was basically what it was. And, you know, our hope was that giving the parents an option for virtual as well, that it would take down the numbers. But at the end of the day, we never received any of that information when they told us that we needed to decide if we were going to continue teaching in person or if we were going to have to take a leave of absence, retire, or resign. And, that's kind of, I guess, my biggest problem is that at no point did we actually have numbers and data helping us assess the situation and figuring out whether it was a risk we were willing to take or not.
Let's just back up a little bit, though. At the beginning of this whole pandemic, which would have been the second semester or the early part of earlier this year, 2020, you were still teaching in the classroom, correct?
Yeah. So I was teaching up until they closed the schools down in March.
In March. And that's
when... continued to teach virtually.
And yeah, that's when everything started virtually. And was that challenging just to start to learn how to virtually teach?
Well, so we were fortunate, I think, at my school district because we had already been implementing e-learning for a couple years. I mean, since I started teaching, my students had iPads. And so we felt like we were in a really good place to try to figure it out. Obviously, there's, you know, a learning curve and figuring things out was a little bit tough. But I don't think that we were in a worse position than any other school. In fact, I think we were in a much better position.
So returning back to school in the fall, did you think there would be better safeguards in place? What did you think was going to happen?
I thought that we had all summer to plan and to pick a lane and to do something really, really well. But because data wasn't being shared, because testing wasn't happening, I feel like I place a lot of the blame, I think, on the top, because a lot of decisions were made from the top down, not taking into account the teachers and not taking into account our experience and the fact that we are professionals in the education system, and we know what the risks are. We know the interactions that our kids have, and that just wasn't put into the equation at all.
Okay, so you get into the classroom, and you're already experiencing issues, so you took the decision to actually resign.
Well, actually, no. So everything was going really well at the beginning of the school year. I mean, I still had to go into the school, which I was okay with because, you know, being in my classroom actually helped me stay focused. But, you know, once the state decided that they were going to change the guidelines, which basically would allow us to have, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was about a 15% positivity rate in schools in order to keep them open. Once that was allowed, basically our superintendents were told that they needed to keep the schools open. And so that's just kind of a top-down decision that came from the state. And at that point, that's when we received a notification saying that we were going to return in person on September 28th.
All right. And then that's when you were starting to decide to just you just felt unsafe being in the classroom.
Yes. And so this also has to do a lot with the decision that my mother-in-law made to retire 3 years. I think it was 3 years early that she retired from the Lake Central School Corporation because they told them to decide in July. And so before school started, a lot of the teachers decided whether they were going to stay or go. And at that point, I made a decision that it just wasn't a risk I was willing to take because if I was going to expose my family to the virus, my son, for example, had already lost his father, his grandfather, and his great-grandmother in the past 7 years. And so I wasn't willing to put my mother-in-law at risk after she had already retired from her school in order to not be at risk.
Right. How difficult of a decision was to resign, especially, you know, you this teaching, I assume, is something that you really love and cherish.
It was really hard. The minute they told us, I think it was a Wednesday, they wanted their answer by that Friday at 3 p.m. I cried, those entire 3 days. And it wasn't so much me feeling sorry for myself. It was me seeing that there were so many teachers that couldn't make that choice. Lots of teachers that wanted to take a leave or that wanted to kind of just put things on hold or have the option to teach from home and do things virtually, but they weren't given a choice. And they were told that they had to either take it or leave it. And if they left it, you know, we're talking about teachers who have been teaching their entire life. That is their livelihood. And they didn't have a choice. And so that really tore me up.
What do you think your school, let me ask you this. How stressed are teachers these days, the ones who actually have to teach in the classroom right now with students involved? How stressed are they?
They're incredibly stressed. I mean, I keep in touch with some of the teachers that I've worked with, and, you know, they're being asked to teach virtually and in person simultaneously while maintaining safety protocols that aren't, you know, that are basically not like nobody's telling anybody exactly what to do, right? So we have this miscommunication situation from the top down, you know, at the even at the federal level, right? And so you have teachers who are kind of on their own in their classroom trying to figure out how to maintain these safety standards, how to protect themselves, how to still be able to carry on classes and engage their students while simultaneously having to teach online. And I'll tell you right now, that's very difficult, and it's not an easy thing to do, and you cannot keep control of a classroom in person and also keep control of the classroom virtually and expect the level of the instruction to be the best. You just can't.
And let me ask you this. What's some of the, before you decided to resign, what was some of the feedback you were getting from parents? Are they supportive? Are they just, you know, blasé about, oh, well, you know, you got to go in the classroom? What's been their reaction?
Well, you know, there was some loud reactions that I've heard from, you know, from a lot of Lake Central parents where they went to the school board meeting and were yelling at the school board telling them that the kids needed to be back in school and all this stuff. So you have that, those people who generally, you know, some of them don't even want to wear masks. They don't really care about the safety. But then you also have some other parents that, you know, are really scared for their kids and they're scared for the teachers and they want to make sure that everything's as safe as possible. And then you have some people in the middle. And the people in the middle are the ones who, you know, don't have a choice. Maybe their kid isn't doing well without any supervision because they have to be in school all the time or because nobody's at home to supervise them. But, you know, so you have those kids where the parents have to work because maybe they're essential workers. And so the parents need to have somebody basically babysit their kids. And I completely can empathize with that. However, you know, it at the end of the day, like nobody was communicating to the parents what was actually happening, just like nobody was communicating to the teachers. So my big issue with this whole thing is that the data isn't put out there. The actual numbers of being affected, how people can be affected, when the decisions are going to be made, and how the decisions are being made, none of that is being communicated at any level to the parents or to the teachers or even to the administrators. I mean, the poor administrators have to just pass along these messages, and they're completely powerless.
Janine, do you see yourself returning to the classroom one day? Do you think you'll be accepted back?
I think I would be accepted back, and I don't know about Highland because I definitely I don't know. But what I don't like the education system, and unfortunately, you know, I'm a new teacher, and I'm cheap, and I'm easy to, you know, just give me a paycheck, and I can probably work at any school. There is a huge teacher shortage already, but unfortunately, I mean, I'm just taking this time to work on other things that I love, and I don't really plan on going back to teaching ever again, to be honest.
Well, Janine Diaz is now a former teacher in the Highland School District who decided to leave her job because of the issues facing school teachers because of COVID-19. Janine, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Thank you so much, Michael. Have a good day.
Thank you. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
We have Brendan and Carrie here from Clancy's Public House out of Portage.
We got Chris here joining us from Gady's Chocolates and Ice Cream out of Lansing.
So we got, we're going to have Nick from Albano's on from Valparaiso. And they just opened up a place maybe 6 months ago in the mall called the Pita Stop. It's very unique. We got the 18th Street Brewery in.
Let's eat with Chef Nick every Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
More Americans are losing access to utility services like electricity, heating, and cooling every day. I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, we'll talk about how the issue of energy insecurity has worsened during the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as a national study on household energy insecurity during this time. More households are left with the choice of sacrificing other expenses like food in order to pay for their utility bills. What's being done to help families from getting disconnected from service? Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I am Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ. In our previous segment, you heard from a former educator who left the classroom due to concerns with COVID-19. Our next guest, McKenna Dilworth, is also an educator and has some specific ways school districts can better support teachers. Welcome to Off Mic, McKenna.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
Great. McKenna, you recently wrote an op-ed in the Times of Northwest Indiana on your experience with COVID in the classroom, but you also had advice for school districts. For just to catch us up really quick, where do you work at and where do you teach at?
Okay, so I'm currently a teacher at 21st Century Charter School right here in the city of Gary. I teach English, German, and social studies.
Wow.
And then, so it's pretty exciting. That's where I teach. And as you mentioned, I just wrote an article about, you know, just what I've been experiencing in terms of this whole reentry plan to physical classrooms and how, just as a teacher, I just felt completely powerless and voiceless in the process, as we were never really consulted about how we felt about it, even given our experiences or given the platform to give our voice some validation.
Well, before we get further along, how long have you been teaching?
Oh, well, I've been teaching in traditional and non-traditional settings for close to 20 years now.
Wow.
So,
okay.
Yeah, because I lived in Alexandria, Virginia, and even before I left Northwest Indiana area, I had already had about 7 to 10 years teaching here, after school programs and that type of thing. I was one of the founding members of the Charter School of the Dunes. And that's what really got me interested in teaching, because I had been avoiding it for years because of that old adage, those who can do and those who can't teach. And so I took that way too seriously and avoided my true calling for years. But then I just reinvested as I traveled and lived in New York City and also Washington, D.C., well, specifically Alexandria. Virginia.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a teacher on the level you are. I do teach classes, journalism at Calumet College of St. Joseph, and I will say I have full respect for educators on any level because it's a great calling and it's not easy to do. But let me ask you this. In the beginning of the year, how was the transition from going from in-person learning to when the schools just shut down and then e-learning took over? Did that happen at your charter school?
Yes. So I would have to give a tremendous amount of credit to our principal at the time. His name is Daniel Velasco. He is just kind of an outstanding leader in that we had already introduced our children to an electronic platform. So they were already sort of used to it, although the whole virtual classes were different. Our children, our scholars, as we call them, were already sort of accustomed to Google Docs and kind of maneuvering through the Google Classroom. So we kind of made a seamless transition to the virtual classroom. Now, from that point to, say, by the summer, we kind of had it down in terms of, like, how the classroom management virtually would look, what, how to engage students and how to keep them engaged, how to gauge how the attendance would be, keeping communication logs. We traditionally had 3 points of contact per family each week, which is about 150 contacts per teacher. So I would have to really take my hat off to sort of how that was unfolded. That was a tremendous amount of leadership skill on the part of Mr. Velasco. And so, which is why I'm so surprised that we as teachers were not given an opportunity to sort of weigh in on how we were going to re-enter into physical classrooms.
Well, McKenna, let me ask you this. What specifically, and not just, you know, I know your experiences are just with the charter school, but in general, and I'm sure you're hearing a lot from other teachers and other school districts, and it seems like a lot of these issues are pretty the same, whether it's a public school, a charter school, or even a private school. What mm-hmm. can school districts do to keep their teachers safe and try to help with some of the stress levels that they're dealing with?
Well, I think one of the things they really could do is exercise leadership. I mean, true leadership in that let's stick with science and health management crisis best practices. If the science is telling you that it's highly contagious and you're not able to accommodate students and scholars and teachers in terms of allowing them 6 feet apart, if you're not able to make accommodations such as face shields around desks and that type of thing, if you're not willing to actually put those types of things into play, I just think it's a better thing to actually go with what we know is safe, which is virtual learning. That's safe. It's measurable learning. It's something that we are getting better at each time we engage in it. It's valuable and it's valued. I think one of the things that COVID has certainly contributed in terms of e-learning is to put more value on degrees that are actually obtained online. Because I know there's a certain level of snobbery that you know, some academics have when you tell them that you got your degree online. But now that the world has a taste of how hard and rigorous and how dedicated one must be to learn online and show that you actually have some learning goals and you've achieved them, now I think it's earned the respect of the naysayers.
Do you think school districts are feeling the pressure, political pressure, to return to classroom? We do know that the president has been putting a lot of pressure on school districts that we need those kids back in the classroom without really, I mean, do you feel like they're just feeling political pressure to have the kids back in the classroom?
Yeah, unfortunately, we are political pawns, I think. And it's unfortunate that, you know, we're looked at as disposable because we're human beings. We're the first line of defense. We're the boots on the ground. And we are the ones who are engaging the children every single day, families, and all of that. And even though we're not at full capacity, they're still even, you know, at 30% capacity, there's still a very high risk of spreading the virus. I think there's tremendous pressure being placed on school systems not to even report their COVID cases. Now, I'm not speaking specifically about the school I am with. That's not what I'm saying. But I do believe that there is pressure on school systems not to even report the outbreaks of COVID. And that's unfortunate because whenever you're pressured like that from the top down, it's inevitable that lives are going to be lost and people's ethical or people's ethical practices are going to be, lenient, to say the least.
McKenna, my last question is, we heard in our first segment a teacher who decided to resign, to leave the classroom because of her concerns with mm-hmm. COVID-19. Is that something you've considered, or have you seen some of your colleagues decide to, it's not worth the risk?
Well, I've definitely seen some of my colleagues
buckle under the undue pressure of just the expectations of some of the deliverables we've been asked to give. Some of the expectations are just certainly unrealistic. And so there is a constant search for other means of employment. So it's just unfortunate. I mean, I'm presently on leave, but eventually, you know, I have to get back into the classroom, and I just feel, for the first time in my life, I just feel like I don't have options.
Well, McKenna Dilworth is an educator in the city of Gary with the charter school of the Dunes?
No, it's with 21st Century
Charter School. Mm-hmm. Well, McKenna, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
All right. Well, thank you. And I hope that, you know, other people get empowered by this, and that some of the people who are actually making the decisions, you know, it would be nice if teachers were at that table alongside the decision makers.
Great. Thank you. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
More Americans are losing access to utility services like electricity, heating, and cooling every day. I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, we'll talk about how the issue of energy insecurity has worsened during the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as a national study on household energy insecurity during this time. More households are left with the choice of sacrificing other expenses like food in order to pay for their utility bills. What's being done to help families from getting disconnected from service? Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
We have Brendan and Carrie here from Clancy's Public House out of Portage. We got Chris here joining us from Gady's Chocolates and Ice Cream out of Lansing. So we got, we're going to have Nick from Albano's on from Valparaiso. And they just opened up a place maybe 6 months ago in the mall called the Pita Stop. It's very unique. We got the 18th Street Brewery in.
Let's eat with Chef Nick every Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. We've been talking about the effects of COVID in the classroom, but it's also taken a toll on first responders. An outbreak is causing a scare in the East Chicago Fire Department. Joining me to talk about the issue inside the fire department is Dave Mata, president of the East Chicago Firefighters Union, Local 365. Hey, Dave, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, Mike?
Good, good. And thank you for joining us here on Off Mic.
Yeah,
well,
thank
Dave,
you for having me.
Tell me, we've been hearing a lot of issues with COVID-19, how it's affecting everything. But with firefighters, the way they do their operation, they almost got two families. You got your family at home and the firefighters who you're having to almost live with. Now you have this outbreak. Why don't you tell us what's going on?
It is challenging. It is challenging as first responders dealing with COVID. But, you know, it's like you said, it's affecting all of us in many different ways. But recently, like I said, we've had this outbreak. It just occurred over the last couple of weeks, which is the first time we've had to deal with this here on our department. Our firefighters, since the beginning of this COVID situation, you know, have done everything. They've gone above and beyond to keep everything clean and keep themselves distanced and follow all the guidelines that we've been, you know, told to follow for our city and for the CDC and everything else that comes down from the state and stuff. So we've been doing a good job of that. That's why we haven't had any in-house related COVID cases up until recently. And, you know, I think all that stems from is the policy. It's a policy issue of why this is happening and why this happened. And that's what we're trying to address to everybody, to the media, is that it's a policy issue that needs to be changed.
Tell us
kind of what we're at right now.
Tell us, what is the policy that's affecting this?
So right now, I mean, as you know, the CDC, we are under different guidelines because we are first responders, frontline workers. So we have a different set of guidelines than everybody else. However, the city policy, they have different rules for other city employees, and they can alter that. They can use the CDC guidelines, and they can alter it, and they could change it and make it and fit it into their city policy like they've done. They just chose to exempt us. So first responders are exempt from the city policy. And under that city policy, the situation that happened on our department where that one firefighter who had a significant other test positive, he was told to stay at work and remain at work. Under the city policy, if that same situation happened to another city worker, they would have been told to go home and stay home until they got a negative test. So we're exempt from that part. If we would have been under that part of that policy, this firefighter would have went home and potentially this spread wouldn't have happened. It might have held this spread from happening to the other firefighters.
Why do you think the city of East Chicago is creating different rules for the fire department?
Well, I mean, I have my own opinions of why, but to be honest, you have to ask them. They're the ones who set these policies and make these rules. They're the ones who chose to exempt us. You'd have to ask them to get an honest answer or to get a answer. I don't know if it's going to be an honest one, but it'll be a answer.
Well, what are you suspecting is caused? I mean, is it politics? I mean, obviously, people want to keep first responders safe, so then why would they create an environment that makes it unsafe?
I don't know. I think politics could play a big role in it, especially everything that we've been going through with the administration since the election and, you know, the ongoing battles that we're having with the administration. That could play a role in it. But I think it's just the basic, they choose not to go above and beyond. They just, if they're given a set of guidelines by the CDC, that's the bare minimum of a guideline, that's all they're going to do. They're not going to go above and beyond, like all the other cities in the state of Indiana are doing. Every other fire department in Indiana has the same guidelines. And yet, if you talk to any other fire department in Indiana, especially our surrounding area here in Lake County, none of them are affected the way we are. They're all included in benefits. None of them have to lose pay. None of them have to use their own sick time. None of these guys have to stay at work if someone in their household tests positive. So they have the same guidelines as East Chicago. They just choose to alter it to make it better to protect the firefighters and police officers. East Chicago just chooses not to. They just bare minimum, and that's it.
So a statement that we got from the East Chicago mayor's office says that the city follows the CDC guidelines for first responders, which requires that first responders who may have an exposure to COVID-19 get tested and return to work, wearing a mask at all times while awaiting test results. It also says the CDC and city guidelines also require that if first responders are sick or experiencing any symptoms, that they do not come to work but get tested and stay home quarantining while awaiting test results. Is that, you take an issue with that? Is that something that they are not following?
Well, that is something that we're following because we are being told to stay at work, so they're following that guideline, which, again, because of the nature of our job and us being first responders, we understand that we can't have all these firefighters off work or all these police officers off work because they have a sniffle or they may feel. We understand that, and that's not what we're trying to achieve here. We're just trying to get this policy changed for the obvious stuff.
But, we all know that it's been reported that through the CDC that, it can take up to 2 weeks before you start experiencing symptoms. It's not overnight. So
right.
If you feel like you've been exposed, I mean, where I work, if you feel like you've been exposed to somebody, you immediately have to quarantine, get tested, and wait for those results at home. So
right.
You're saying that that policy where they're requiring people to come into work after they've been exposed and awaiting test results, that's causing people to get sick.
That I think is why this outbreak has happened, I believe. Yes. But it is, again, like I said, that the firefighters do have a different set of guidelines under the CDC because of, we can't have all these firefighters off for certain reasons. But it doesn't mean that the city can't alter their policy to include us in case we have someone at home test positive to stay home. not come back to work. That should be an obvious one that they can easily just go and change the wording and say, okay, well, CDC says this, but we're going to not let you come back to work because we feel that's a danger. They don't want to do that. And then there's other reasons. You know, there's, you know, the change of this 8-hour shift has another reason. I mean, now we're even lower manning. We used to have 23 guys a shift. Now we're down to 13 or 14. So, of course, they don't want to send us home because losing one guy means they're going to have to get in more overtime. I mean, they're already in this huge overtime crisis as it is because of the shift that they created. So I think that's another reason that plays a part into why they exempted us, because they just, you know, they can't afford to send us home because of the shift they created.
Right.
So I think that plays into it also why they chose to exempt us.
Dave, a lot of people might think that, you know, because of COVID-19, well, let me ask you this. Are you still responding almost to like the same level of calls you would even if COVID-19 wasn't around?
You know, believe it or not, this year, because of COVID-19, we have seen a drop in call volume. Not as many medical calls as we used to go on. There has been a little bit of a drop, and I think that has a lot to do with the fact that a lot more people are home, staying home. So I think there's a lot more people who are more alert of everything that's going on in their household and stuff like that. But the call volume is still there. I mean, we're still at almost 1,600 calls for the year. So the calls are still there. I just, maybe to me and from my shift, it's not as busy as it was last year, but I think it's because of how many people are staying home and being a little bit more alert and stuff themselves. But still doesn't change the fact that we still have to respond to calls. We still go into these people's homes. And, you know, it kind of plays into what we're trying to achieve by changing this policy, is by having firefighters come to work knowing that a household member was exposed. Now you go respond to these calls, you're still entering these people's homes. And I'm pretty sure if you told that resident, hey, this firefighter's spouse was exposed to COVID and he's awaiting results, they probably would say, hey, I don't want you coming in my house. You know? Mm-hmm. So it's a risk not only for us, but it's definitely a risk for the public because of how much we go into these people's homes to care for them.
Have you, do you know what the policies are in neighboring firefighter departments? Is it different from yours?
Well, I don't have all the details on their policies. What I do know is, talking with a lot of the firefighters from other neighboring departments, is they don't have the worry that we do. None of those firefighters, if they get exposed, have to worry about losing salary, any kind of pay. They don't have to worry about losing any of their sick time. They don't have to worry about being told to stay at home or stay at work. They go home. They don't have any financial burden on them. And so they feel a little bit at ease that knowing that if they contract this thing or get exposed to this, that they're not going to suffer, their families are not going to suffer any financial burden. You know, so they have a little bit different policies, you know, than we do.
Dave, bottom line is, what are you asking? What do you want the policy to be in the East Chicago Fire Department?
Well, I would like them to sit with the union and to go over some portions of this policy to include us in. For one, obviously, the biggest one is to just include us in the portion of staying home if we're exposed to somebody until we get our negative results, and then we come back to work. That should be a given. You know, I would like us to be included in some of these, a few of these benefits under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. We're exempt from that, and there are a lot of benefits in there that I understand that we can't get, and I understand that, but there are some that would allow firefighters to get at least the financial portion of it. So a lot of these firefighters, these young firefighters, we got to remember, understand that East Chicago has over 30 firefighters with less than 5 years on the job. So they don't have, you know, adequate sick time built up yet. They're still developing that. So a lot of these guys are fearing that if they contract this thing, not only do they got to go through this disease, but now they got the burden of being hit financially by not being paid because they're off.
And do firefighters have to wait, sort of like just the general public, sort of that 3, 4, 5 days to get your test results back?
It's been crazy. This last time with this outbreak, there's guys, matter of fact, there's still guys now, I believe, that are still waiting results from October 2nd. why is it taking this long? I don't know. But it is a long time for these guys to be waiting, especially in a situation like this. We should be having sent to get rapid tests done. You know, that's something that we asked the city to look into, is to testing first responders on a regular basis, not just when something happens, but every week or something. We should be tested on a regular basis to keep this continuous, you know, in our system, to make sure that we're okay to come to work and work around the public. So we've offered some ideas in the past. We've offered some ideas as recent as Monday, and, you know, we don't know if that's going to go on deaf ears or if they're going to actually, you know, take us up on that, sit down with us and kind of brainstorm some ideas to maybe change this policy a little bit better to help our firefighters.
You know, not to tout my own reporting, but back in August, I did report that East Chicago had the highest COVID-19 infection rate of any community in Northwest Indiana, and actually one of the highest in the state of Indiana. And we do know East Chicago is primarily made up of African Americans and Hispanics, who are already nationally suffering higher infection rates. So, you know, you have all those factors in there, and now you're facing it. Well, Dave Mata is the president of the East Chicago Firefighters Union, Local 365. Dave, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
We have Brendan and Carrie here from Clancy's Public House out of Portage. We got Chris here joining us from Gady's Chocolates and Ice Cream out of Lansing. So we got, we're going to have Nick from Albano's on from Valparaiso. And they just opened up a place maybe 6 months ago in the mall called the Pita Stop. It's very unique. We got the 18th Street Brewery in.
Let's eat with Chef Nick every Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
More Americans are losing access to utility services like electricity, heating, and cooling every day. I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, we'll talk about how the issue of energy insecurity has worsened during the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as a national study on household energy insecurity during this time. More households are left with the choice of sacrificing other expenses like food in order to pay for their utility bills. What's being done to help families from getting disconnected from service? Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
I got all the time I want. I got a time machine. I can just go back early and warn him. Okay, 10 minutes ought to do it.
I don't mind, but you better promise me I'll be back in time.
There's the pitch to Baines. Swinging a fly ball. This will be it. Center fielder's got it. Cruz is tagged. Here's the throw. Not in time. Stop Flynn. The White Sox have won the 1983 American League Western Division title on a sacrifice fly by Harold Baines in the ninth inning.
I don't mind, but you better promise me I'll be back in time. I gotta get back in time.
Well, welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. We're having a little fun there with the Back to the Future music and song because, hey, our next segment, our sports contributor with WBEZ, Cheryl Ray Stout. Cheryl, welcome to Off Mic.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good. The reason I'm playing that because the rumors are having it that Tony La Russa, who got fired by the White Sox, 30 years ago at least, may be heading back to the White Sox. Everyone's been talking about it. I've been talking about it. So we thought we'd have a little fun there in the top segment. What are you hearing? And of course, catching up with people, I think they've heard that Rick Renteria was let go by the White Sox a week ago. But then these rumors started swirling about Tony La Russa. What have you been hearing?
Well, I'm hearing reports from Dave Nightingale from Sporting from USA Today that's saying that the White Sox have extended an invitation to Tony La Russa to talk to them about the managerial job. They had to go through the Angels, and the Angels said yes because he's working with the Angels organization. This is kind of weird because in the press conference we had with Rick Hahn on Monday, he said specifically he wanted somebody with recent playoff experience as far as a manager in an organization. So now Tony La Russa has not only just been with the Angels, he's been with the Red Sox, he's been with the Cardinals. He's been with organizations that have playoff experience, but he personally has not had some in many, many years. So I don't know if this is a truism. The only thing I could think of that possibly could be on the minds of the White Sox management is maybe they may bring Tony in and have somebody that they really want as to be the future manager so he could groom that person. Or this is a herring that something else is going on.
Do you think, I mean, it seems like the only person who probably would have reached out to him is the Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner of the White Sox. You think maybe Tony feels like, hey, you owe me from what happened back in the late 80s when Hawk Harrelson, who was the general manager mm-hmm. then, decided to fire me. Do you feel like any of that is into play here?
Well, and I'll never forget 1986. It was one of the worst years I've ever covered a team. That was when Hawk Harrelson did fire Tony La Russa. I know that Tony La Russa and Jerry Reinsdorf are extremely close. They're very, very close. And Jerry's always felt bad that he allowed Harrelson to make that decision to fire Tony La Russa. That said, the one thing that about this rebuild with the White Sox, and it's a completed rebuild, is that he's allowed Rick Hahn to do and make all the decisions. So that's why this seems weird, because I don't see Tony La Russa being the one person that Rick Hahn is pointing to. The other thing is, could this be the fact that they really want to get A.J. Hinch? And if you have everyone clamoring about Tony La Russa, that his real get would be A.J. Hinch, who, of course, is attached to the Houston Astros scandal. He was fired from that job for cheating. So it's very incredible at this point.
It would seem weird that, like you said, that Jerry Reinsdorf felt bad that he allowed Hawk Harrelson. And yeah. People are probably wondering, Hawk Harrelson, used to be the voice of the White Sox. Well, at one time, he was the general manager, and he decided to fire fire Tony La Russa just a few years after Tony La Russa won the division mm-hmm. race for the White Sox, getting the White Sox to the playoffs for the first time in years. So, but it almost seems weird, though, that he would force Rick Hahn to have to hire Tony La Russa. That doesn't seem right either. But I guess we're just going to have to wait and see how this all plays out.
Yeah, it's definitely quite the game that's going on right now. And one thing that Rick Hahn did say that they will not announce a hiring until after the World Series, which is, of course, that's what the league wants you to do, because there are some people he was interested that's involved with the playoffs. With that said, again, this saying that's a slam dunk for Tony La Russa just doesn't, in my mind, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But if it does happen, there's obviously other aspects to it too. Like I said, looking for a manager that they want in the future to be maybe his bench coach. That's the only thing I could think of that would make sense of this. Otherwise, it's lunacy.
No, I know a lot of people have been talking about A.J. Hinch and Alex Cora, mm-hmm. both of them got caught up in that cheating scandal, and say a lot of fans say, well, we don't want cheaters with the White Sox, but somebody is going to hire those managers and may benefit from their expertise in baseball with a young team. But do you think it makes sense for the White Sox to even consider those two who were caught up in that scandal?
I think you have to consider them. I think that there has to be a lot of contrition on their part, and I think that they're going to have to really sell it to the White Sox fans so that they don't get turned off by a hire such as that. You know, sometimes you have to give somebody a second chance as long as they are truly regretful for what they did. But I think sometimes fans won't forgive anybody. I think no matter who gets hired, White Sox fans will always say it's wrong.
Right. So, but bottom line is, I know a lot of people were discussing this too. Are the White Sox allowed to start talking to coaching candidates and they just can't announce who might get it?
Right, exactly. They have channels that they could go through to talk to somebody if they're still active right now. If anybody's in the playoffs right now, they can go through channels, but they can't make any announcement yet, unless it's an off day. But the fact is, with the playoffs, they're playing every day. There's not an off day until the end of these series, going into the World Series. So it's going to be. I don't expect an announcement to be for at least a couple weeks.
And Cheryl, just going back just a little bit, were you surprised that the White Sox got rid of Rick Renteria and Don Cooper, the pitching coach?
I wasn't surprised. Once I was looking at when the season ended. Generally speaking, the general managers always talk within a day or two of the end of the season, no matter what, playoffs, World Series, you know, bad seasons. And the fact that they took over a week to do that, my senses said something was up. So I wasn't surprised about Rick Renteria being let go. When I asked the question of Rick Hahn about the staff, that's when he let us know about Don Cooper. And I think that surprised a lot of people because he had been with the organization for over 30 years and the last 18 in the dugout as the pitching coach. So that was more of a surprise than Ricky Renteria.
Do you think if Rick would have, if the White Sox would have gone at least to the second round of the playoffs, that may have saved Rick's job? Or you think maybe they felt like they need a more experienced coach to lead the Sox into the future?
I think the last 2 weeks of the season, after they clinched and then they struggled so bad, and then some managerial choices he made in that third game, I think that pretty much put the writing on the wall. Now, had they won that series? Yeah, possibly, but I think everything was going in a downward trajectory at that point. So I think the answer was made once they finished.
You know who's going to be most happiest if the White Sox hire Tony La Russa?
Who?
I think it's going to be David Ross, because they're not going to call him Grandpa Rossi anymore. He's going to be eclipsed.
Let me say this about Tony La Russa. When I first started covering, he was the manager of the White Sox. And he personally took me to security guards, since I was the only woman going in there, and said, look, she's got credentials. Before then, we didn't have our pictures on our credentials. And he made sure that I was not hassled by anybody. He was always extremely good to me. And I produced his radio show on WMAQ Radio.
Wow. So you got some sort of, you know, affinity for him, for the way he treated you and everything. And here I'm giving him a hard time.
No. You know, I could see, because there's a lot of question marks about him being flawed, especially the steroid issue with the A's and with the Cardinals and some other things. But personally, for me, I don't have any issues.
So, okay, really quick. I want to get to the Bears, but I got to ask you this. The NBA just wrapped up its championship. The Lakers won. When's the NBA supposed to start back up?
It doesn't look like it's sometime after the first of the year, it seems like.
It just
both
seems like,
NHL
yeah.
and the NBA are not even putting in stone any type of schedule. So it's going to be a few months. At least.
Yeah, because it's going to be really tough, because they've been in this bubble and they're not going to be having that safety of the bubble anymore.
Right, and I think that, they learned that it worked for them, but they're also seeing what's going on. Look what's going on with college football. Look what's going on in the NFL. We're seeing cases that are stopping games and the fact is that there's such a high uptick now going on with the coronavirus that there's a lot of concerns in the next few months. It could get worse for sports. So I think the leagues are being very cautious about moving ahead with any schedule.
All right. And the Bears have a Sunday game against the Panthers. We don't know which team is going to show up, the one who played well against the Buccaneers or the one that just flopped against our Indianapolis Colts.
It's going to be interesting because Teddy Bridgewater is the one that's guiding the Panthers, and he's won their last three games. And the Bears' defense really put the clamps on Tom Brady, so that's a really good, matchup between those two factors. But the interesting thing, can the Bears score in the third quarter? That's something they haven't done all season. The only team in the NFL that has not scored in the third quarter.
Wow. Well, that's all the time we have for with Cheryl. Cheryl from WBEZ, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic.
You're welcome, Michael.
Well, that is all the time we have for this episode of Off Mic. You can catch this again as a podcast by going to lakeshorepublicradio.org. For my staff, for the producers, Jose Rodriguez, Tom Maloney, D. Dotson, and my student intern, Emily Gomez, want to thank you for listening to Lakeshore Public Radio on Off Mic. Like to hope you have a wonderful weekend and stay safe and wear those masks. Take care.